Good morning. So last time we finished up talking about monitors. And monitors where we had a number A mutex plus condition variables. We have this rule that we locked the mutex before we touched anything. We have some shared data. These mutex and condition variables were related to. Whenever we had a reason to wait for something, like we wanted to wait for a buffer to be empty or full, we added a condition variable for each reason and added code to broadcast, or maybe if we're careful, signal when the condition changed, when some thread that was waiting could stop waiting. We also talked about a reader-writer lock and saw how we could implement a reader-writer lock with mutexes and condition variables. The idea of a reader-writer lock is that if we have a shared data structure, reading it usually doesn't require any synchronization. The data structure doesn't change, all the pointers are the same, all the values are the same. So as many threads as we want can read it, but we can only have one writer at a time because that writer could mess up any of the threads reading it. And so we have this lock where we have read locks where you can get as many as you like across all the threads, and write locks where exactly one goes at a time. And we saw we had two options for implementing them, which was reader priority and writer priority. And we saw that when implementing these with monitors, it was fairly straightforward by just counting how many writers and readers were waiting. We could just figure out who else is waiting, and we can make our condition be, you should go if there's no readers or there's no writers or whatever the condition was, and also no one else is waiting that shouldn't be. And we can use this generally to just choose priorities for any sort of synchronization construct we have. We can use monitors where we have the shared data track, whatever we want to make our decisions based on, and just wait while that thing isn't true. Like, while there's waiting writers, readers don't go. And we can generalize this like up to like having a queue, our own queue for every thread with like a Boolean, and we can order that queue however we want. Though this probably ends up duplicating what hopefully our condition variables or mutexes are doing internally, but maybe we need to do that if we want the queue in a different order than our condition variables have it. But we have the power of doing that. So any questions about what we covered last time? So I made an error in the last lecture, which is I decided, I'll be clever and avoid signaling sometimes, rather than copying the code out of the book, which is correct for a bounded buffer example. Said, okay, well, if we're producing, we can't produce because the buffer's full. So when the buffer becomes not full, that means one producer can go. And that's true. But problem is that what happens next is not necessarily that that producer goes. The thing which could happen right afterwards is another consumer goes. Because remember, when we signal a condition variable, that doesn't mean that the thing we signal gets to run early enough to get the lock first. Someone else might sneak in before them and get the lock. And this is what I forgot when I was making this example. And there's two fixes you can use. So one is you can unconditionally signal. And the logic for this is each consume operation allows up to one produce to go. And if we're signaling on an empty wait queue, we don't really care because hopefully the condition variable is fast at figuring out, the queue is empty. Or we can broadcast, and that would solve the problem because that's the only, if the buffer is full, that's the only case where we have waiters. And if we wake up all the waiters, we know that we're not missing any. We might be waking up more than we need. In fact, we almost certainly would be, but it would definitely work. And we could also like do our strategy we did for reader-writer locks and like have a count of how many waiting producers are there and decide whether to signal based on that. That would also work. And generally, how can I have avoided this problem? Like, the thing you should think about in a question like this where you want to write broadcast or signal is who's waiting? And it's almost always more than one can be waiting. And if not broadcasting, you need to explain why each of them gets to go eventually. And my implicit explanation was the queue will be full again first, and if I like wrote that down, I might read it and say, oh, that's not true. Another way of thinking about it is like what is consuming cause threads to go, and remembering that I can empty the buffer by consuming. Another way of thinking about it is, well, I can just write down the possible things which can happen because we can only have produce or consume, there's two operations, I can actually like exhaustively figure out all the possibilities. I can like work out what's possible if the queue has two items on it. The buffer has two capacity two. Like all the interleavings. Okay, so that's how I messed up last time. So let's talk about the quiz. So there's one question that a lot of people got wrong about cache coherency. And they ask true or false, after a processor finishes updating a value, another processor can still have an old version of that cached. What we were getting at is that we mentioned updating a value, you get the cache block into the modified state, and as part of doing that, you tell all the other caches, hey, I'm writing this, you shouldn't have it. And they all go into the invalid state. And I was pretty concerned when I saw that most people got this wrong. When I read the comments of the small number of people who wrote comments, a common, I don't know if it's a majority misinterpretation, because probably most people who wrote comments could have had a completely different reason. They interpreted, invalid state as it's cached, but it's invalid. That's not how we think of the invalid state. When someone says a value is no longer cached, they mean we set it as invalid, because there's no possible way you can ever read an invalid value. If you try to read it, the cache is going to say, no, I don't have that. So even if it's like happens to be in like some bits in a memory on the processor, like there's no way you can get at it, so it's not cached. Like there's not any operation which exposes it. It might as well have been cleared, even though you're right that the easiest implementation would not actually clear it. It would just set some bits elsewhere saying it's invalid, don't look at this. Okay, so any questions about this? Okay, so also the lifeform work is happening, as most of you I think have figured out. So some common things I've seen in office hours, which surprised me. So one thing, lifeboard. If you declare a lifeboard, you're making a separate board. If you assign to it, you're making a copy of the thing you're assigning. So like if you have one of these per thread, each thread now has its own board. That's probably not what you want, because you want all the threads to work together to compute one grid, not separate grids. And this occurs even if, say, this life board is in a struct that you're passing to the threads. That's different for each thread. Also, the simulate function returns by modifying a reference that's passed to it. So if you're confused about, why I'm printing out my board, it looks right, you better make sure it's the same one that was passed in as a reference that you're printing out the check. Because a common mistake I've seen is computing the right value and not putting it in the board that we expect to be modified. Okay. So that's, any other questions about the life homework? Yes?
So in that direction, so it was like, you said that there are two ways to kind of handle the swap. So there's like the even off thing.
Yeah.
And then there's just like swapping.
There's at least two ways, yeah.
So like, could you explain a little bit like the reasoning for the even off?
So the idea is, in either case, you're going from one to the other and then back. And the idea with even odd is that you just say, I'm going to say that this is I'm going to get a pointer to this and a pointer to this, from and to, and in the next iteration, I'm just going to make my pointers be to and from. And you just change which ones you point to when you're doing things, rather than actually moving the values into two boards. And the even odd is just that on even iterations, you're going in one direction, on odd, you're going in the other. That clear?
I have one more question.
Yeah.
So for the speed up, like if we're using a virtual machine, like so I'm seeing significant speed up on this 1 and 2 threads. But like, is it supposed to be showing speed up on every single one on virtual machine?
So the question is, when will it be faster? So let's say I'm running 1,000 threads on 2 cores. What do you expect to happen? What are some things that are going to be happening that might not be happening when I'm running, say, 2 threads in 2 cores? Yeah.
Lots of context switching.
Yeah, so lots of context switching. That's the minimum. So as we add more threads than we have actual hardware to do, we're going to do context switching to fake that we have those extra cores, which we don't. And we're also going to do more work synchronizing, like the barrier is going to be spending more time figuring out how many people are there, and you're also going to be spending more time like calculating which row am I at. So as you add more threads, yes, it's probably going to end up getting not as good as when you match up the number of threads to the number of cores. And that is 100% normal. And if you're running a VM which only has one CPU exposed to it, so it only can use one core at a time, then two threads probably won't help because it's context switching between those two threads. Okay, so last time we gave our first example of deadlock, which is that, let's say, driving, my algorithm for driving is I reserve the road in front of me, it's clear, I can take it, and because I'm moving forward, presumably no one else is gonna go there. And we run into a problem where two people just decided, okay, this road was free, I could get onto that bridge, and now I am stuck. And someone has to give in here, or else no one's gonna make progress. So let's go through another example of the same kind of problem, a different scenario. That's our dining philosophers. So we have 5 philosophers at a table who alternate between thinking and eating. This is the phrasing from Dijkstra. I believe Dijkstra used forks, and so they needed 2 forks to eat, but we're gonna go with chopsticks because that makes a lot more sense. So they each need to pick up 2 chopsticks to eat. It's hard to use one. And they're gonna grab one on either side. So we have this simple algorithm. Everyone grabs the chopstick on their left. Then everyone tries to grab the chopstick on their right. And so no one has it. And unless someone gives in, we're at an impasse here. No one's gonna make progress. They're all looking, staring to their right, saying, when are you gonna be done? Okay, so these are both sort of toy examples, which don't seem like things that matter for like real programming. We're not going to be coding a system which manages chopsticks. And if we are, we might, you know, do it in a way where like we, like, take turns figuring out who gets what chopsticks, so we don't have this problem. But this kind of problem occurs all the time when people try to write multi-threaded programs. And here's one example that we might have seen earlier. So here I set up 2 pipes, one from child to parent, one from parent to child. The parent writes, sorry, the child writes to the parent writes to the child, then they both read from each other. And if the huge size constant, the size of the thing we're writing, is big enough, this is gonna hang forever. It will just not, will never terminate. So what's the problem? So first of all, where is the parent waiting when it's hanging? Where is the parent stuck? And there's 2 options. It's either stuck on the right or the read. Which one do you think?
Well,
So let's say it was stuck on the right. What would happen? Why would the right not finish? What would be happening? So the parent is trying to write to the child. It's writing a lot of data, and that's important for this problem. Why would the right not be able to finish? What do we need to do? So we have to put the data that's being written somewhere. And when right returns, the contract is that the data is written, that it's out of our hands, it's in some data structure in the kernel. And the kernel's not going to give us infinite space to do that. So we don't have enough space for the huge data we're writing, and it's not being read right now because the child is writing too. So it's just going to wait, and it's going to wait forever because the child never ends up reading it. And the reason the child never ends up reading it is because the child's in the same scenario. The child is writing a lot of data to the parent. It's asking the kernel, hey, please hold this so the parent can get it. That's what the right call is asking. Please take this data, save it so the parent can get it. And the kernel says, I don't have enough space for all of that. I'm going to wait until, you know, some space gets freed up by someone reading part of that data so I can take the rest in. So the result is now our child is writing to the pipe, and it needs free buffer space to store that data in before write returns. And that space is not going to be available until the parent reads. But the parent can't read yet because it's writing to the other pipe waiting for free buffer space, which it's not going to have available until the child reads. So this is the same example of that someone has to give up in order for anyone to make progress here. That as long as the parent is waiting for all its data to be sent into the buffers and that to happen, and as long as the child is also waiting, no one can make progress. They're both stuck, and none of them are going to help the other out by reading some of that data they're writing because they're stuck. And this is what we call a circular dependency, that the parent process is waiting for space to write in the buffer from the parent to child, which needs to eventually be read by the child process in order to free up that space. Meanwhile, the child process, which is responsible for doing that read to free up space, is waiting for space to write on the child to parent buffer, but that needs to be read by the parent process in order to free up space. So we have, this is what we call circular waiting. It's circular waiting because when we draw this picture connecting what are we waiting for, who's waiting, we get a loop. So questions about this scenario? And I mentioned this scenario because this is a thing people really do by accident. And it's really subtle because if you don't have a big size, it doesn't hang. But when people like try to say, I'm going to have two-way communication with this other program, this is commonly the code you'll write, and it won't work. So what's the solution to this problem? Yeah. Yeah, so one solution is that we swap the read and write for one of them, and that would solve the problem. And we'll see some more ideas for solutions later. But keep that in mind, that was a solution. And it's kind of not nice solution because, you know, right here, the code is nice and sort of parallel. The parent and child do the same thing. That makes nice sense. Unfortunately, that doesn't actually work out very well. Let's look at another example. So here I have my implementation of a file system, and I have a directory which has a lock and a list of files that are contained in the directory, which are represented by dir entry structs, directory entry structs. And I have a function to move a file between two directories, And it acquires the lock for both of the directories because we're changing that list. We don't want anyone else to like read half a broken list. You know, while like we're reallocating the space where this map is stored. And then we write copy the entry to the to directory and delete it from the from one with the lock held. So it happens all at once. We never see like the file in two places at once, nothing like that. Then we unlock the locks. And this has the same circular waiting problem if it's used in a particular way. So here, if I move from A to B, some file, and I move from B to A, another file, even though these are different files, there's no actual interference here. But because we're sharing the directories, we have a potential for the same circular waiting problem. So when things work out well, like we do one, then the other, that's fine. We lock one, lock A, lock B, do the move, unlock B, unlock A, and lock B, lock A, do the move, and unlock them. That's fine. And even if we kind of do them almost at the same time, things also work out fine. That I can lock A, lock B, and thread 2 comes in, it tries to lock B, it waits for a little bit of time because B is locked, the move happens, B gets unlocked, it locks B, it tries to lock A, A's still locked, but A gets unlocked quickly, so it finishes waiting, does its move, everything works out great. So these are both of our lucky timelines. And in fact, they're the common case, that usually one of these two ways is how the timing is going to work out because the operation that takes a long time is the actual changing the maps of string to directory entry, and the whole thing doesn't take very much time, so usually they happen separately. But sometimes we can get very unlucky. And we do these both at almost exactly the same time. So the move from A to B acquires the lock on A. The move from B to A acquires the lock on B. And the next thing the move for A to B wants to do is wants to acquire a lock on the to directory, B. And it can't get that. So it starts to acquire that, and it's going to wait. Then the move from B to A wants to acquire a lock on its destination directory, A. It can't get that because thread 1 has it. And it waits. And there's nothing that's going to stop these from waiting. The reason why we assumed acquiring the locks like this was safe is that, well, eventually we do the move and unlock these locks, but all that code is unreachable now because we're waiting for the other thread. Then we have another example of a circular dependency, and all these circular dependencies are known as deadlock. And this is sort of the reason why our threads are dead, because of the locks. It's sort of intuition. So we have our circular waiting, that thread 1 is waiting for one of the locks, which is held by thread 2. Thread 2 is waiting for the other directory's locks, which is held by thread 1. That's the type of scenario we have. We have, again, this circular dependency. And we can also have this in a more complicated situation. So here we had, moving from A to B and B to A. That's kind of easy to detect, but we can get this in uglier situations where like we have three directories involved, where we have one thread that's waiting for directory A's lock, which is held by thread 2, which is waiting for directory B's lock, which is held by thread 3, which is waiting for directory C's lock, which is held by thread 1. This whole giant loop, and we can keep adding threads to this, make it more and more complicated, more and more ugly, and obviously this is rarer. We have to have more timing happen to work out in a very unlucky way. But, if we're running a system if we're running like 1,000 machines for years, this will probably eventually happen. So the scenario here is something like we lock A, we try to lock B, which is locked by thread 2, which is trying to lock C, which is locked by thread 3, which is trying to lock A, which is locked by thread 1. So questions on this scenario? So this is deadlock with locks. We also saw deadlock with pipes. Where pipes, you know, we can assume, like, do this waiting for the buffer to be full. We can have it with other kinds of resources that aren't so obviously shared. Like with the pipe, we know, hey, the parent and child both need this pipe to do something. One needs to read, to hold data it reads, one needs to hold data it writes with these directories. But all these threads are sharing particular directories they're both accessing. We can have it with less obvious sharing. So one example here is, let's say that instead of having malloc that fails, I want to have a malloc that just waits for the space to be free. Seems like a reasonable choice. You know, our system has things going on. We're just gonna, you know, wait a while, space will free up. And so I have thread one, allocates a megabyte. Then it needs to do some computation, allocates another megabyte, does the calculation with all that data, then frees it up the space. Thread two is doing the same thing. And if we have only 2 megabytes of space, this can cause the same sort of deadlock problem, that we get this unlucky order, thread one allocates a megabyte, then thread two allocates a megabyte, and now in order to proceed, both of the threads need to allocate more space before they'll give up any of the space they have and we're out of space. Whereas in a typical case, we won't notice this problem because happily things will work out in a different order. So here's deadlock where it's less obvious that the resource is a shared one, but the shared resource is just space and memory because we do this. So this is, all these are examples of deadlock. So it's circular waiting for some kind of resource. Our most common case for deadlock, we're going to talk about a resource where there's a lock that represents the resource, like our directories. The resource we're waiting for is access to the directory entry list, and the lock represents that. But we can also have deadlock with resources which don't have an obvious lock, like space and memory. But it's something the thread needs to do to actually make progress, something the thread's waiting for that, you know, it can't keep going. And deadlock is when we have circular waiting, so the thread's waiting for that resource, and another thread has that resource, but happens to directly or indirectly be waiting for the same thread that's waiting for that resource. So we have a loop when we make this picture where we have our who's waiting on what, and who has what resource. And deadlock is a really annoying problem, mainly because it's non-deterministic. Now, we saw all these examples where if the timing works out very slightly differently, everything is great. That as long as no thread sneaks in between the time you acquire those two directory locks, nothing can go wrong. You just have to have this slightly unlucky timing, which means that testing for deadlock is really annoying. That you can run your test hundreds of times, thousands of times, millions of times and never see it. And in fact, you're guaranteed never to see it if you only test one thread at a time. Or you never test A to B and also to A. Like if you only test moving from particular directories, never moving from and to them at the same time. You know. So it's an easy thing to miss, and it's something we're going to want to design to avoid. So questions on our definition here, our informal definition. We'll have a more formal definition coming up. Okay, so there's another concept we talked about here, which is related to deadlock, and I'd like to make sure you don't confuse it with deadlock, and that's starvation. So starvation means that someone is unlucky and doesn't make progress, and someone is lucky and does make progress. So our classic example is low priority threads. If there's enough high priority threads, the low priority threads never get to run. This is not a deadlock problem. In deadlock, no one involved in the deadlock No one who's responsible for any part of the deadlock gets to do anything. They're all stuck. Another way of thinking about it is in starvation, there's a solution we can use to deal with the starvation, which is just take turns. That if we have low and high priority threads, we can just say, we're gonna run one thread at a time until they finish, and everyone will get to finish. That we can run the high priority, let the high priority thread take its turn, let each low priority thread, and everyone will finish. With deadlock, that's not gonna work. We let the person who's waiting on the lock take their turn, they're gonna say, I can't do anything, I need the lock. You know, taking turns won't fix the problem after deadlock happens. It would fix it before deadlock happens, but after deadlock happens, we're stuck. With starvation, after starvation happens, we could fix it by taking turns. So let's talk more formally about what's involved in deadlock. And our main motivation for doing this is that when we try to define what makes a deadlock happen, this is going to tell us how to systematically make sure it never happens in our code. And that's obviously a very useful thing and a reason to have this more formal definition. So our deadlock has, well, four requirements. So one is mutual exclusion, that if we don't have resources that only one thread can have at a time, there's no deadlock. If everyone can access the directory simultaneously without a lock, we can't have a deadlock with it. Because everyone just does it, they don't wait for each other, there's no problem. We need to have this hold and wait property. That if we acquire a resource and never acquire another resource while we have that resource, we can't have a deadlock. We need to be holding some resource someone else might wait for and be waiting for another thing to happen. That we need to have a lock, for example, and try to acquire another lock. That is, if we only acquire locks and then unlock, we're fine. That it matters that we have some resource that someone could wait for while we're waiting for something else. So if we only wait when we don't have anything, if no one can wait for us. We don't have anything for them to wait for. So that's the hold and wait property. We need to have no preemption of resources. So when we think about our case of like the one-way bridge, the natural human solution to that is that someone's gonna give up. Someone's gonna say, I don't need to have my car on this segment of road. I'm gonna back up and give it away. That there's some way of getting a resource taken out from under you. In order to have deadlock, we don't have that. That once I've acquired the lock in the directory, I'm not giving it up until I'm done. That you can't take it from me while I need it. But if we have preemption, we might say, for example, that if you really need that directory, I'm gonna let you steal it from this other thread that was trying to use it, even though that thread thought they locked it. And we also need our circular wait property, that you can have a list of threads where you say, this thread's waiting on the next thread, is waiting on the next thread, is waiting on the next thread, is waiting on the first thread. Whereby waiting on me, waiting for a resource that is being held by the other thread. Held in a way where we can't steal it from the thread. So, any questions on any of these properties? Our mutual exclusion, one at a time, hold and wait, that we have some resource while we're waiting for another. No preemption, that no one steals, and the circular wait that we actually have a loop. Okay, so we can just apply each of these to come up with a bunch of ways that we can avoid deadlock. So I'm gonna go through a bunch of these. Some of these are pretty trivial and also pretty impractical. And some of these are much more practical and will actually do it. So one is that if we have infinite resources, we'll never run out. So in our case where we were deadlocking because we were waiting for memory, if we just have infinite memory, we can't wait. And this gets rid of our mutual exclusion problem, that there's no resource one thread can hold and keep others from getting at it. But this doesn't work for some kinds of resources. So for memory, this is a great solution. If we just have infinite memory, no one's going to wait for memory. And infinite doesn't actually need to mean infinite, it just means to be enough for anything you possibly want to do. Another example is this, is that if you have a producer-consumer case, and you're worried about deadlock involving that, or like our pipe buffer, if we make the pipe buffer big enough, no one needs to wait. So in our pipe example, if we just make that buffer big enough to hold the huge size, we don't have deadlock anymore. Another solution is no shared resources, that you just say every thread has their own memory, their own directories, their own pipes, and they never share it with another thread. So this solution obviously doesn't work for some programs. Like your life program, you have to have shared resources. You have to communicate your results. But for some things, this is a practical solution, that if every program runs with its own file system, its own through disk, there's no possible way that that move file deadlock could happen. And this is avoiding mutual exclusion. It's not the case that one thread needs to take turns using a resource. Everyone has their own. Another thing we can do, which is starting to get into the more practical for real things, is we can avoid waiting. That rather than, while we're holding a resource, wait for another, we just say, we're just going to give up. And the analogy for this is how our phone system works, that if you call a number that's currently in use, you get a busy signal, rather than, say, waiting for them even if they're calling you. And the idea is that when instead of waiting, we're going to give up what we're doing and retry the whole thing. So we could apply this to our allocate example, and this is in fact what malloc does. When you malloc a megabyte and it's not there, malloc doesn't wait, it just says no, sorry. And that prevents this deadlock. We allocate, and when we get unlucky, instead of having a deadlock, we get our malloc failing, and we learn, oh, I'm out of space, and hopefully I clean up and actually free up the memory. And the tricky part is, well, I gave up, what do I do? So one thing is I can just give up entirely. I can say, well, that program I was running can't have been that important. Which sometimes is an option. That's probably what you've usually done. Malloc fails is you just exit and say, hey, I'm out of memory. Don't run me when I'm gonna run out of memory. That's often an okay solution. You could have them both try again. There's a bit of a problem, which is that they might keep trying over and over and over again and have the same thing happen every single time. That's a problem called live lock. It's not deadlock because people might make progress. Like if you take turns, it solves the problem. Or you could try to like add some extra logic and say, oh, you're giving up a lot, I'm gonna have you actually take turns now to make sure that someone succeeds. That's a guaranteed to work solution. It's hard to implement, but I could imagine that some systems might really do it. Like in a database, you could potentially do that real solution for real. So another thing we could do is we could, instead of allocate or fail, we could allocate or steal. Now instead of malloc failing, it's just gonna say, okay, you're asking for a megabyte, someone has a megabyte, and they're gonna give it to you. So we just say, okay, you asked for a megabyte, this other thread too is using a megabyte, well not anymore. Now it's a dead thread, and everything's good for you. So this is a bit problematic, but a real strategy you could use. The main issues are, well, first of all, how do you logistically implement this? Like you have to track who has what, so you can figure out who do I kill, how do I make them give up their resources. And the biggest concern is, are things in a consistent state when I did this? And you probably, in a real system, are going to need to do extra work to make sure they are. But assuming you do that work, so when you kill the thread, you can like make sure it resets everything it was working on, this could work. And we can do both of these things I showed you for memory with locks. So for the fail case, pthreads implements this. So there's a pthread mutex trilock, which is basically lock or fail. So it acquires the lock if it's available, otherwise it tells you, sorry, couldn't get it. And the idea is that you could use that result to abort and retry later. Now pthreads doesn't implement locks that you can steal away, but this is a thing that databases sometimes do. They implement what you may call revocable locks, and a sort of the kind of implementation pattern you could have is you do something conceptually similar to throwing an exception in the thread that had the lock stolen from it, and you make sure that there's handlers for that exception that do all the cleanup you need to get done. So you undo what was being done, and that lets you take the lock from them while they have it, and lets you assure that you made progress. So this is something you could implement. It's not very common, but in a database, it has the advantage that you can make sure all the code which is using the lock follows this convention that you can like throw that, hey, your exception saying, hey, you give up now, I want to use the resources you have it actually clean it up. In particular, in a database, the cleanup code is usually easier to write because the database needs the same code to handle like this machine loses power. So it's actually, there's a reason to have that code anyways. Okay, so these were real solutions, including one that you can even use for locks, but these are kind of unsatisfying because they require lots of changes to our code that uses locks. They require us to have like these loops where we keep trying things that may never succeed. So they're typically not the solution we're actually going to use. And this next solution is the best one for most applications when we're talking about locks. Like this solution doesn't make sense for like memory space, but for locks, we just acquire the resources in a consistent order. We just say, I'm going to get A then B, never A then B sometimes, and B then A the other times. So, for example, we could change our move directory. So instead of acquiring the from directory lock and the to directory lock, we compare the path names of the directories, and we acquire the one which is alphabetically first. And this prevents us from having a cycle that if we're doing A, B, that we're always going to acquire A then B. And if we're doing B, A, this is A then B still. We always do A then B. We don't have any circular waiting. We always get the A first and wait for whoever else needs A. And note that the order like really didn't matter, it just mattered that we had an order. So we could even have done something like compare pointers. We just needed an order that all threads agree on, that everyone goes, it takes the A directory first, or everyone takes the B directory first, so they never have the alphabetically later directories while they're waiting for an alphabetically earlier one. And we can't have cycles because when we're waiting for locks, we always have our pointers from A to, from a thread with A to a thread with waiting for B, C, D, E. Like the pointers always go in that direction in our graph, so we never have a loop in the graph. you know, to be clear on that. So we might have like B, but that B is going to go to C, D. So edges, can't write today, edges to later letters only. That's the only direction our edges go. We can't have a cycle. And this is by far the most common solution in real software. That in real software, they're going to say there's a particular order we acquire locks in all the time, and we're always doing that, and that's how we know we don't have deadlock. And the case where it's really tricky is cases like this, where you have this sort of symmetry that you need to break, where the natural thing is going to be that you're going to have an inconsistent order. But this comes up in more natural cases. And typically, if you're making a piece of software where you have multiple locks, you're just going to explicitly define a convention. And you'll probably even write it down. So for example, here are some real comments from the Linux kernel about lock order, saying, hey, if you're writing code that uses this stuff, you need to acquire this LDT user semaphore first, then the memmap semaphore, then the context lock. That's the order we acquire things in. First LDT user semaphore, then memmap semaphore, then context lock, never the other order, any other order. Or similarly, if you want to write this code, you first acquire this slab mutex, then a nodes list lock, then a page's slab lock if you need it. Like, this is the order. If you need these locks, you acquire them. And this is across any piece of software which has multiple locks where there's, you know, you might not know what order to acquire them. This is generally what the solution looks like. Now, it's kind of unfortunate that, like, this isn't enforced by the compiler or anything like that, that you actually need to check that your code does this, but that's typically the best we can do. So any questions about our lock ordering idea? Okay, so our last solution is to just request all the resources at once. So this can take multiple forms. So one form is we could say that rather than having a lock for each directory, we have a lock for all the directories. No problem, right? You can't possibly have a conflict. There's only one lock. So that's one version of the solution. The other version of the solution is that, like, for example, when starting the thread, we just reserve all its resources all at once. Otherwise, we don't start the thread yet. And then we don't have to worry about the thread holding resources that someone else wants, because it either has all its resources or it has nothing. So there's nothing to worry about. So any questions about any of these prevention techniques? And the big thing is this is by far the most useful one. It's just have a consistent order, especially for locks. That deals with almost all our actual deadlock scenarios. Yeah?
Can we say what's all resources at once? I mean, like, if it needs A and B, it'll lock both A and B at once, or it won't lock, or it won't wait.
With
requesting everything at once?
Yeah. So requesting everything at once, the idea is that we'd somehow have like a lock multiple operation that might lock A and B at the same time. That's typically not a thing we can really do, but you could like have a global lock for everything, for example. Or you could like acquire a global lock, lock A, lock B, release the global lock. And that's effectively the same as getting A and B at once, assuming everyone does that. So other questions on our strategies here? Okay, so we talked about deadlock and preventing deadlock. So there's another thing people like doing with deadlock, which is detecting deadlock. And there's a couple reasons you might do this. So one thing is that we can And if we design our system in a particular way, we can do something in response to deadlock. This is what databases commonly do. Databases commonly have locking, which lets deadlock happen. And when deadlock happens, they fix it. Not all databases, but this is a real thing people do in databases. Another reason might be debugging, that I would really like it if my debugger told me, hey, your program is hanging because you're waiting on this lock, while this thread is waiting on this, so I could figure out what the deadlock problem was and what locks I needed to like reorder. And the idea is that we're gonna take that graph I showed you earlier and search for cycles in it, dependencies that form a cycle. So let's say I want to do this just for mutexes, but I only care about deadlocks that only involve mutexes. I'm not caring about like an allocate and wait situation. And I'm gonna modify my thread library. So I'm implementing like pthreads. I'm gonna add something to my struct that represents the thread and my struct that represents the mutex in order to be able to tell the programmer, hey, you have a deadlock and this is what the deadlock is. What should I add? Can someone tell me something that would be good to keep track of in order to figure this out, to tell the programmer, hey, your system, tell the programmer that can like say the system's hung, the programmer can ask me, hey, what's the deadlock I have, if any? And I can re-look at my threads and my mutexes and figure it out. What should that information do I need to do that? Yeah. So you want to know how much time we've been waiting for?
Yeah, so if it goes over a certain time, you know it's a deadlock.
Okay, so your idea is time waiting. So problematically, that doesn't guarantee that there's a deadlock. Like that's a heuristic. But it's not a guarantee. Like, I could have a thread which locks something, computes on it for a day, unlocks it. That's not a deadlock, as long as it's the case if I wait for that thread, let that thread keep running, it will release it. Waiting. So there's no, this is not a guarantee, but it might be a useful thing, like, heuristically, to know there might be a deadlock. Yeah. So the question is, I set a flag on what? In the lock? In the mutex? Every time I try to lock something. And if that flag is set in something I'm trying to lock, I assume there's a problem. Well, the issue is that if someone else has that lock, it's not necessarily an issue, right? Like, it's only an issue if they're waiting for me. Yeah. Okay, so one idea is we set a flag every time a thread is waiting. So we have a m waiting value here. For mutex. And your proposition is that if everyone is waiting for a mutex, we have a deadlock. And I agree. If everyone is waiting for a mutex, there must be a deadlock. So this is a sufficient condition to detect a deadlock. It is not a necessary one. We can still have a deadlock, for example, two threads are waiting on each other, but we have a couple other threads that are running normally. But I agree that that would work, that would detect real deadlocks when that happens, we know we have a deadlock. So that's a reasonable idea, yeah. Okay, so one thing that would be useful to know is a list of threads of who's waiting. And what would we use this for?
You can make the
dependency graph. So there's one other thing we need for the dependency graph, which is we need to know who has the lock. So if we also know thread holding. That's enough information to draw the pictures I showed you earlier. And when we draw that picture, we get a graph. You might vaguely remember from 2150, we talked about topological sort. And topological sort is like incidentally finds if there's cycles. So we do that, we see if there's a cycle, and if there is, we have a deadlock. So that's a way which detects it even when not all our threads are deadlocked, only some of them are. Yeah. Sure. So the idea is that we have our list of waiting and holding. So we have a lock, and everyone waiting on the lock, we draw an edge. So waiter one, waiter two, and everyone holding the lock, the thread holding the lock, we draw an edge. And we also have this with other locks. So if there's a cycle, we'll find it, and we'll say, okay, that's the deadlock. Yeah?
It seems like it could be a fairly lengthy process to run the topological sorts, or when do you start it?
Yeah, so the question is, this seems like it's fairly expensive, and it is. The hope would be that we only run this when we have a good reason to suspect there's deadlock. And the suggestion of time waiting is probably a good one. That maybe we only run this when we see some threads have been waiting for a couple minutes for a lock. We know that's not necessarily a deadlock, but that's something which is going to happen if there's a deadlock. So we use that, like, maybe to decide to run this algorithm and see if there's actually a deadlock. We also note that there's other expenses that in order to run this, we actually like probably need to stop all the threads so we don't like read an inconsistent view of who has what lock. But yeah, so that's a basic idea for deadlock detection. We track who has what lock, and we can figure out if there's cycles in that graph. We just draw the graph by having the information of who's waiting on what, who holds what. This is the graph, we find out if there's cycles. So we have all the contended resources that we want to detect deadlock in. We have who's waiting for what and who owns what. So we can do this. So you just need to tracking of who locked what. Now, this is a lot of work. So every lock we use, if we care about detecting deadlock with it, we need to modify that lock in order to do this tracking. And that means that, well, maybe we used a spin lock before. Well, sorry, you probably can't really. You need something more complicated in order to do the tracking. And there's some resources which it's not obvious what to do, like a counting semaphore. Like, we might need more information about what the semaphore is used for in order to see if there's deadlock. Because we like don't really know if a thread calling down on the semaphore is acquiring a resource or just like letting another thread go. Or doing something else. So the first part is we do that instrumentation, but however we do it, we hopefully figure out the graph. Then we have the hard part, which is, what do we do if there is a deadlock? Like, we can't just let the threads take turns. That's not going to solve the problem. They can't go. So we need a way to undo operations, to do the equivalent of having the car back off the bridge. And as I said, databases do this. So they have custom locking code. That's how they can do all this tracking. And they have code which undoes operations because they need to handle like a power failure. So if like they're in the middle of an operation and the power goes out, they need to make sure that operation doesn't like happen if it's not completely done, so they can reuse that code to deal with the undoing things when there's a deadlock. So this algorithm of taking our graph like this and looking for whether deadlock happened seems nice. There's one case that we didn't really handle. Can someone think of a case where we can't really draw this graph this way and have it and find cycles and have it work? Something, one of the examples of deadlock I showed you earlier, this doesn't really work for. Yeah?
One, two cars
So with the two cars, the idea there is that we have our bridge, and we just say we have this segment of road is A, and this segment of road is B. And this is the graph for that. That makes sense? But there's something where we couldn't do that sort of assignment. Yeah? When we're allocating memory, because like each megabyte of memory is interchangeable. So there is a generalization of that. So we have divided resources, you know, where each thread owns a megabyte of memory but can use others. So you want to track like this partial ownership, that a thread is locked half of memory, not the whole thing. So we get graphs that might look like this, where we have our divided resources and we track like each part of the division separately. And this seems a lot more annoying if we actually want to do this. So how do we figure out if there's deadlock when we have a graph like this? So here is an example of deadlock. We have three units of memory. The program is waiting for two of them. And that's enough that the other one needs to wait. But if it's only waiting for one, it would be fine. So what is a way we can do this? And note that we're not going to do something especially efficient. So what's something we can do that figures this out? And we're going to take advantage of one of the distinctions I gave you between starvation and deadlock. So with starvation, if we take turns, everyone gets to finish eventually. So what we're going to say, our algorithm is going to be simulate progress. So anything that's not waiting releases resources. Anything waiting on only three resources takes those resources. So we're just saying, let's say you don't have anything more to wait on that we don't know about yet. Let's just see if we're stuck. Like, if we let you keep running and you presumably release the resources you have, rather than waiting for more resources, because that's the current status that you have these resources, you aren't waiting on anything. Then you get rid of those resources, do we actually make progress eventually? So in this case, we say, well, none of these threads can go, there must be a deadlock. But if thread two wasn't waiting on resource B, or like there were two units of it, we'd say, well, thread two acquires resource B, then finishes and releases resource A. Because we just assume everyone finishes. And we just keep doing that until none of the threads can do anything if we assume that anyone who's not waiting finishes. So does this make sense? Our algorithm is basically assume anyone who's waiting on free resources gets them, assume anyone who now is not waiting on anything finishes and releases everything they have, and if we keep doing that until no one does anything, we should end up with everyone freeing all the resources. If we don't, we have a deadlock. Now, what people are waiting on right now is a problem. And this works even for this case where we have divided resources. So our sort of pseudocode is that we go through all the threads. If the threads are requesting less than what's waiting on, less than what's free, they take it and then release all the resources. They can keep going and release everything they have, and we keep going that until we either run out of stuff to do or we've made all the threads be free. So everything requested is free. The thread just doesn't need anything. It releases all its resources because it gets those resources that it's requesting, uses them, finishes, and now owns nothing and keeps going. And we just keep trying to finish threads until we're done. Until nothing can happen. Okay. so any questions on this idea? Okay, so usually we don't worry about this case because our most important case for deadlock is the lock one, where fortunately we don't have locking half of stuffing. Okay, so whatever we do for deadlock detection, that's a reasonable thing where we react to that. We can also use this for prevention. That's one application of a deadlock detection algorithm. But we need an additional wrinkle, which is that we need to know what the maximum resources are. Because otherwise, we're not preventing anything, right? If we don't know what you could wait for, we can't do this. So this is not often practical, but some historical systems have used this idea that we know what you could wait for, and we check when you start the thread that we're definitely preventing deadlock, because we know if you wait for everything you could wait for in any order, you're not going to cause a deadlock. Everything's going to be fine, and when starting a process or a thread, we can make a decision. Doing that, we just ask, what if everyone was waiting for the maximum they could wait for? If that would cause a deadlock, we don't start another thread. So this is historically important. I don't know anyone who does it, so we're not going to test you on it, really, but this is an idea you could use. The main problem is, this seems like a hard thing to know. So how about recovering from deadlock? So if we're not using deadlock detection to prevent deadlocks, you must be using it to fix deadlocks or debug them. Debugging them, that's straightforward. We just tell the user, hey, you have this lock, which was being held by something waiting on this lock, which is being held by something waiting on this lock, which is being held by something waiting on the first lock. And you can read that and you can figure out, oh, I need to decide on the order for all these locks that's consistent. I can look at where my threads are and figure out why was I violating the order I might have thought I had, and so on. But if we want to actually just automatically fix the deadlock, we have our two choices is kill a thread and tell the owner involved. And I told you about one way databases would fix it is by just tell the owner of the lock, hey, undo what you were doing, give up the lock. And the other option of killing the thread, and you might say, no one would ever do that. Well, Linux does. So Linux has something called the out-of-memory kill. And this is because Linux overcommits memory. Linux tells processes, hey, you have that memory, no problem, allocated it to you. And sometimes that doesn't work out. And you could wait for memory to be free, but that would cause a deadlock. So the solution is we just kill a process to free up the memory. Hopefully we don't choose a process that's too important. You might imagine that some recommend disabling this feature for good reason. But this is really a solution people use in addition to the telling owner to release and undo an operation. So about deadlock. So a problem with dealing with deadlocks in the sort of tell an owner to release the resource is that they presumably retry. Right? That's what they're going to do. So we can end up, if we try to use this strategy, replacing deadlock with live lock. I mentioned live lock earlier, let's be more concrete. So here's an abort and retry version of our move directory code. Rather than doing an order, I've decided I'm just going to use try lock and just keep going until I get both of the locks. So does this code up here make sense? We try to get the first lock, we try to get the second lock. If we don't, we unlock the first lock, try again. And this avoids deadlock. But we can have a problem, which is that we could keep doing this. We could do this for an arbitrarily long time, depending on how our thread scheduler works. And many would say that this is worse than deadlock because it's a lot harder to debug. Like, how do you figure out that this is happening other than, huh, my program's really slow? And it's using all the CPU, what's happening? Because that's often what this looks like. Because eventually, like, the schedule, something else runs, and this doesn't happen anymore. So there are some solutions to this. Like, you can, like, randomize the schedule to avoid it. You can make the threads wait after unlocking. That's probably the best idea, is have some random waiting to give a chance. And it's random, so they don't actually sync up. You can make them run one at a time, and so on. But generally, you know, well, the summary I want you to get about deadlock is that what you really should be doing is the consistent order. That the deadlock is the cycle. There are other solutions that sometimes are good ideas, but the most common solution is going to be that consistent order. It's way less complicated, and it avoids all these sort of weird problems of trying to do this abort and retry style stuff. That as long as you can figure out, I do A, then B, every time, even if my arguments are BA, you can solve this problem, and that's usually what you want to do. So any questions on deadlock in general, live lock? Yeah. Okay, so that concludes our discussion of threads most likely. I have some potential topics I have prepared, but we probably won't talk about them. So in my last 3 minutes, I'm going to talk about not using threads. Threads are hard, they're bad, they're really hard to use. And there are other solutions to all the problems threads solve that some people would say you should always use instead of threads. We're obviously not quite of that opinion here, but it's worth knowing about the general solutions. So one idea is event-based programming. So a common use of threads is like you have a server which handles multiple users at a time, and a natural thing to do is like have a thread per user. Like if you have a web browser, you have a thread for every web browser that's requesting something from your web server. Or if you have a web browser, you have a thread for every web page you're displaying. But maybe you don't really need multiple cores because you have one network. Right? How fast is that network? It's only so fast. You can probably deal with that with one core. And you're using threads just because you want to read from one browser while reading from another browser. But there's another way we can do that, which is that we're basically going to read and write from multiple places at once. That we're going to have an event loop that's going to tell us, hey, you have a new connection, or hey, you have some data on a particular connection. And this is going to let us, in this loop, we're going to handle one of the connections each iteration of the loop. Rather than having them handle in separate threads, we have one thread which just switches between the different connections based on what event happens. Whether we get input from one, whether we can write to another without waiting anymore, and so on. And I messed up that slide. Okay. So the idea here is that, you know, where previously we would have code, this handle read and handle write code would previously, you know. Previously within a thread. Thread per connection. Here we're gonna have the code save its state to this connection data structure, and this is going to hold local variables of the thread, of previous thread code. So where previously we like have a local variable tracking, hey, what did I just read? What command did I just read from this web browser? We're gonna keep that in this data structure that we look up in a table. In every iteration of the loop, we look up what connection is it, what's the current request we're dealing with, and so on, and we handle that in this event. So this is a very common programming model, and it has some advantages over using threads, which is that, for example, there's no way I can have deadlock here. There's no locks. There's no way I can have a synchronization bug, because there's no locks. The only thing I have to worry about is that it's going to be tricky to write these handle read and handle write functions compared to the threaded code, where I could like keep a local variable. Now I have to stuff everything I would put in the local variable in my connection data structure. Okay, so that's what I have for you today. So next time we're gonna talk about virtual memory, which you may or may not remember from 3330 or your other architecture course.